When I think of Hollywood, I don't just think of movies and stars. I think of a place that's filled with stories of success and failure, where untimely and suspicious deaths are unfortunately just waiting to happen. In this lecture, we'll examine several historical cases from Tinseltown and see how scene investigation and autopsy are crucial in analyzing mysterious deaths. Now, if you're around my age or older, you likely remember the opening of the Superman television show. It began, "Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound." Well, unfortunately, it turned out poor Superman, as played by George Reeves beginning in 1952, was not faster than a speeding bullet. In fact, George Reeves was one of three Superman actors who all died by unusual circumstances. Actor Christopher Reeve, that's without an S, played Superman in four movies released between 1978 and 1987, but fell from a horse in 1995, became paralyzed, and eventually died from his injuries in 2004. And remember the infant Kal-El, who Marlon Brando sent to Earth in a space pod in the first Christopher Reeve movie? That baby Superman was played by Lee Quigley, who died in 1991 at age 14 while huffing solvents. You know, that's when kids inhale things like glue or gasoline. Now, because of these and other coincidences, some have suggested the role of Superman is cursed. I don't know about that, but the original TV Superman, George Reeves, certainly died a mysterious death that continues to haunt forensic history. George Reeves was born George Brewer in a small Iowa town in January of 1914, although much of his life he thought his birthday was the following April. That's because his mother fudged his birth date, since George was born only 5 months after she married his father, who she quickly divorced. After moving to California, George's mother married a man named Besolo, claimed her new husband was her son's father, and gave the boy Besolo's last name. When she decided to divorce her second husband, the man George thought was his father, rather than tell her son the truth, his mother told George that Besolo committed suicide. As a teenager, George began boxing, including in the 1932 Olympics. His mother made him quit, though, so he wouldn't ruin his handsome face. And in 1939, that face made its first major on-screen appearance as one of Scarlett O'Hara's admirers in Gone with the Wind. Now, by that point, Warner Brothers Studios had renamed him George Reeves. In 1943, George was drafted into the World War II Army Air Corps. But rather than a combat assignment, he acted in Broadway Army plays in New York and made training films. And after the war ended, Reeves returned to Hollywood. But after he couldn't land any good roles, he moved back to New York, which I didn't realize was the hub of the early television industry. When Superman, which was already a popular radio series, was proposed as a TV show, Reeves hesitated to audition, since television was a brand new medium, and who knew it would catch on? But Reeves tried out, and his self-assurance and muscular build won the role. Filming began in the summer of 1951. The first episode aired in September of 1952 and was an instant success. It ran for 6 years, eventually in 21 countries. Now, the role of Superman typecast Reeves, and he couldn't seem to get any other meaty roles. So instead, he capitalized on the marketing that followed superhero status. I'm sure some of you out there had Superman lunchboxes, Halloween costumes, or maybe action figures. Reeves seemed to really love the personal appearances, and he made more money from them than his actual salary. In public, he tried to embody the Superman persona. He never smoked in front of kids, and he was involved in several charitable organizations. He kept his personal life, as a big partier and drinker, private. Many willing women threw themselves at him. And in the early 1950s, Reeves began a long-standing affair with Tony Mannix, who was 8 years older than he was, an ex-Ziegfeld Follies girl, and the wife of a successful MGM producer. Apparently, Mannix's husband didn't interfere with the relationship because he had his own girlfriend. Reeves and Mannix were involved in charities together and often seen as a couple in public. Now, Mannix was said to be very possessive of Reeves and bought him a house and a car. But the Man of Steel still had a mind of his own. In 1958, Reeves met Lenore Lemon at a New York nightclub. She was a well-known party girl from the city's in crowd and allegedly the only woman ever thrown out of the Stork Club because of a fist fight. When Reeves took up with Lemon, Tony Mannix began to harass him with daily phone calls. Although Reeves and Lemon had a rocky relationship, they planned to marry in the summer of 1959. But that speeding bullet I mentioned earlier took George Reeves' life in the early morning hours of June 16, 3 days before the wedding, when he was just 45 years old. The evening of his death, George and Lemon went out to eat with writer Richard Condon and were overheard arguing during dinner. Then they all went back to Reeves' house, the one Tony Mannix bought him. Condon was working on a book about prize fighter Archie Moore, who Reeves was scheduled to box the very next day. And later, two neighbors showed up at the party. According to the house guests, Reeves went upstairs to bed in a bad mood around midnight, only to come down later to complain about the noise the rest of the group was making. Reeves had another drink before going back to bed. And later on, Lemon was quoted as saying, "Oh, he'll probably go shoot himself now." About 2 o'clock in the morning, they heard a single gunshot. And one of the neighbors at the party, William Bliss, ran upstairs and found George lying on his back, naked, partway on the bed with his feet on the floor and a 9mm Luger pistol between his feet. There was a single fatal gunshot wound to his right temple. Now, what evidence do you think investigators would seek to help establish whether the shooting was a suicide, homicide, or accident? Well, they would definitely start with a thorough examination of the bedroom, collect any evidence there, including the gun, interview anybody in the house at the time of the shooting, and ultimately autopsy Reeves' body. So let's see what they discovered. For one thing, the house guest didn't call police until 30 or 40 minutes after Reeves' shooting. Officers reported the witnesses were all really drunk, difficult to interview, and gave no excuse for the delay in calling. Were they buying time, maybe, while they straightened out their stories? A single bullet casing was found beneath Reeves' body, which suggested he was probably sitting on the edge of the bed when shot and then fell backward onto the casing. The bullet that struck Reeves was recovered from the ceiling, but there were two additional bullet holes in the bedroom floor, which Lenore Lemon claimed were from a few days before when she was, quote, playing with the gun. Interestingly, after telling police Reeves had been depressed, Lemon left California the very next day. She didn't even attend Reeves' funeral. Initially, since the witnesses all agreed the death was a suicide, Reeves only received what was called a, quote, cursory autopsy at the funeral home before he was embalmed. But Reeves' mother raised suspicions. And because Reeves had reported incessant phone calls to authorities a few months prior, which he attributed to Mannix but could really only be traced to local payphones, well, they conducted a more thorough autopsy at the L.A. County Coroner's Morgue. Luckily, blood samples had been taken before the embalming, and they revealed a blood alcohol level of 0.27. That's over 3 times today's U.S. legal driving limit. Toxicology tests also showed painkillers in Reeves' system that had been prescribed following a recent car accident. The fracture patterns in the skull were said to be consistent with a close shot. And while that type of wound can leave traces of gunpowder around the bullet entrance, there was reportedly no powder on Reeves' temple. In contact wounds to bare skin, though, most of the gunpowder enters the body, leaving little skin residue. Now, if this case happened today, they'd do residue testing on Reeves' hands as well as anyone else at the party to try and verify who was holding the gun when it was fired. But the scanning electron microscope method that we currently use for such tests wasn't available in those days. Neither were the types of elemental analyses that could detect lead, antimony, and barium from gunshot residue. Now, what about the gun itself? Well, it was recently oiled, so no clear fingerprints were found anywhere on it. Based on everything investigators discovered, the LA County coroner ruled Reeves' death a suicide. Helen Besselot, Reeve's mother, wasn't satisfied. She refused to have her son's body cremated and buried and hired her own detective to investigate his death. In January of 1960, 6 months after the shooting, Reeve's body was sent to my hometown of Cincinnati for yet a third autopsy. Although his remains were deteriorating, this autopsy again supported a finding of suicide. Reeve's mother finally agreed to cremate his body 3 years after his death and shortly before her own. During the death investigation, rumors surfaced that Mannix had hired a hitman to kill Reeves for abandoning her. Lenore Lemon was furious when she learned that $50,000 of Reeves' estate was to go to Tony Mannix. A third-hand account, attributed to a neighbor present the night Reeves died, William Bliss, alleges Lemon instructed the other witnesses to tell police she was downstairs during the shooting, but that she really hadn't been. All those people are now dead, and the facts about what actually happened died with them. As a superhero, George Reeves fought a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. Though suspicions may still exist, it looks like the official ruling of suicide will stand, whether it's true or not. If his death was not at his own hand, America's Superman didn't get the justice fought for by his character. Now, if George Reeves tried to be a public angel in the 1950s, another Hollywood icon who made it big in the 60s was known as a real bad boy. Bob Crane began his career as the king of the LA airwaves. He was the first DJ to earn over $100,000. But Crane was best known for his starring role as Colonel Hogan on the sitcom Hogan's Heroes, ironically set in a World War II German prisoner of war camp. The show ran from 1965 to its cancellation in 1971. From there, Crane's career went downhill. In 1973, he bought, acted in, and toured with the play Beginner's Luck, which performed mostly at dinner theaters around the U.S. Crane's bad boy status stemmed from an insatiable sexual appetite. He was constantly picking up women and often enjoyed group sex. Crane frequently played drums in topless bars and was an avid fan of pornography. He would brag about his sexual addiction and exploits to anybody who would listen, even when it made people uncomfortable. Crane's sexcapades and too public private life may be why he didn't get many roles after Hogan's Heroes. But during the sitcom's heyday, Bob Crane met and became friends with a guy named John Carpenter. A carpenter worked in the video department of Sony Electronics during the time when home video equipment was first popular. He and Crane began recording Crane's sexual exploits, often without the knowledge of others involved. Crane also had an extensive photo album of his many partners. The jealous boyfriends or husbands of the women involved sometimes caused major problems for Crane. Now, Crane's wife at the time, Patricia Olson Crane, who went by the stage name Sigrid Valdis, wasn't amused by any of this either. She had played the Hogan's Heroes POW camp secretary, Hilda, which is how she met and married Crane. They were in the process of a divorce in 1978 when Crane met his untimely death at age 49 in Scottsdale, Arizona. On the night he was last seen alive, Crane appeared in his play Beginner's Luck at a Scottsdale dinner theater. While signing autographs after the show, he was overheard to remind his co-star, Victoria Barry, about a meeting they had at noon the next day. Later that night, his apartment neighbors heard Crane having a heated phone argument with his wife, who was in Washington at the time. Following that, Crane went to a bar with two women and John Carpenter, who was visiting Scottsdale. At about 2 a.m, the four were seen going into a coffee shop. A carpenter left a half hour later and before the other three, since he had to fly back to L.A. later that morning. Around 2 o'clock the next afternoon, Victoria Barry came to Crane's apartment to check on him, since he had failed to show up for that noon meeting. The door was closed, but not locked, unusual for Crane. And when Barry went into the darkened bedroom, she thought there was a woman with long dark hair in Crane's bed. Turned out what Barry thought was dark hair was actually streams of blood. Crane was lying in the fetal position on his side with an electric cord wrapped around his neck. Blood was spattered on the adjacent wall. Investigators determined the scene showed no signs that Crane had struggled during his death. Smears on the bed sheets looked like someone had wiped blood on them, possibly while cleaning off the murder weapon, before then pulling the sheets up over Crane's head. Blood was also found on the inside of the apartment's door. A Crane's wallet was there with money inside, so robbery was ruled out as a motive. The only thing known missing was the large photo album of Crane's sexual conquests. A huge collection of pornography was found at the scene, and the bathroom had been turned into a makeshift darkroom full of photo developing equipment. At around 3:15, while Victoria Berry was giving her statement to the police in Crane's apartment, the phone rang, and she was instructed by the cops to answer it. The caller was John Carpenter. The police lieutenant took the phone, identified himself, and told Carpenter police were investigating, quote, an incident that had happened in Crane's apartment. Carpenter said he had been with Crane until 1 o'clock a.m. that morning before returning to his hotel to leave on his morning flight. Carpenter later revised the time he last saw Crane to 2:30, but never even asked the lieutenant where Crane was or what the investigation was about. The Maricopa County Medical Examiner's autopsy concluded that Crane was likely sleeping on his right side when the killer delivered two blows to the left side of his head with a heavy blunt object. The time of death was estimated between 3 and 3:30 a.m. The lack of a reaction in the soft tissue showed that the electric cord, which had been cut from a video cassette recorder, had been tightly wrapped around Crane's neck after his death. When asked if the perpetrator was likely a man or a woman, the medical examiner said the killer was probably a strong man due to the blood spatter pattern analysis. Now, in these types of assaults, once blood gets applied to a weapon and the blunt object is raised for another blow, the blood gets cast off onto other surfaces like the walls or even the ceiling above the victim. The crime scene showed little height to the spatter, suggesting to the medical examiner that the killer was strong enough to deliver a second bone-crushing blow with something heavy without needing to really swing it back and get momentum behind it. In fact, they speculated a camera tripod could have been the weapon. So obviously, things were pointing to John Carpenter, who, by the way, some said was bisexual and wanted more than a friendship with Crane. People said Crane was trying to get rid of Carpenter. There were reports of them arguing at a local restaurant just days before Crane's death. Now, Carpenter's prints would be expected in his friend's apartment, but investigators had another place to look for clues. Carpenter had rented a car during his visit to Scottsdale, so police brought the vehicle in for an investigation. On the inside of the passenger door, they found a small amount of blood. Now, 1978 was before DNA profiling was available. The best analysts could do was determine the blood was type B, and while that was Crane's blood type, a little over 15% of the world's population is also type B. Had this crime happened today, DNA testing might have made this an open and shut case. But at the time, blood typing just wasn't enough evidence for police to arrest Carpenter. When DNA technology became available in the mid-1980s, it prompted an international reopening of so-called cold cases. And in 1989, investigators tried to get a DNA profile from the blood sample preserved from the rental car, but by then it was too degraded. Nevertheless, in 1992, Carpenter was arrested for Crane's death, but the Maricopa County prosecutor just couldn't make the charges stick. Now, this was prompted by a reexamination of photos from the vehicle that revealed a tiny fragment of red matter on the electric window button on the front passenger side. Several forensic experts testified it could be human tissue. In fact, might have been brain matter. But the defense rightly argued that something that small could not be adequately classified from just a photograph. Carpenter was acquitted, but he lived under a cloud of suspicion from Crane's death until his own in 1998. Okay, we've talked about a superhero and a Hogan's hero. Now, how about a martial arts hero? And no, I don't mean the 2009 death of David Carradine of the hit 1970s TV show Kung Fu, although that was a forensic issue, ultimately determined to be accidental autoerotic asphyxia. I want to discuss instead the 1973 death of actor and kung fu legend Bruce Lee, whose first well-known Hollywood role coincidentally intersected the world of superheroes. Lee played Kato, the Green Hornet's sidekick, kung fu pun intended there, on both the Green Hornet and Batman TV series of the 1960s. But those weren't his first roles. Lee's father was a Cantonese opera and film star whose fame helped place Lee in 20 films spanning the first 20 years of his life. Bruce Lee was born Lee Jun Fan in San Francisco's Chinatown, but grew up in Hong Kong. As Lee's neighborhood went downhill, street gangs sprung up, and young Lee's fighting days began. At age 13, Lee's father started him in formal martial arts training. But as the gang violence increased, his parents began to fear for Lee's life. And so in 1959, they sent him back to San Francisco to live with an older sister. Lee later gained the attention of a Hollywood producer at a martial arts competition. In addition to playing Kato in the mid-60s, Lee choreographed Hollywood fight scenes, but his heavy foreign accent held him back from leading roles. So Lee returned to Hong Kong, figuring starring as a martial arts hero in Asian films might ultimately lead to a Hollywood career. He was right. By 1971, Lee had his breakout roles in Hong Kong. The next year, he was given complete control as writer, director, choreographer, and star of the hit The Way of the Dragon, which includes arguably the most famous martial arts fight scene of all, in which Lee fights his friend and competitor, Chuck Norris. That film got Lee the Hollywood attention he had been seeking. Little did anyone suspect, Lee's next film, Enter the Dragon, co-released by Warner Brothers and a Hong Kong company in 1973, would be his last. Bruce Lee was young, apparently healthy, and in top physical shape. He worked out rigorously, was a health food fanatic, and incorporated traditional Chinese supplements into his diet. Lee pursued a serious mind-body-spirit type connection. He wrote poetry and philosophical sayings. From all appearances, the man was healthy in both body and mind. Now, working at the studio on Enter the Dragon in Hong Kong in May of 1973, Lee collapsed into a seizure. He was taken to the hospital and diagnosed with cerebral edema, that swelling of the brain due to excess accumulation of fluid. He was treated with mannitol, which is a sugar alcohol that acts like a diuretic and increases fluid loss through the urine. Lee told his doctor he had used hashish from Nepal the day before and wondered if there was some kind of connection. Now, hashish is a concentrated resin from the buds of the cannabis plants that marijuana comes from. But hash contains more THC, which is the active ingredient in cannabinoids. Lee's doctor warned him that the purity of the Nepalese hash made it very potent. Lee's wife said the actor didn't use hash often, nor did he show extreme effects when he did. Bruce Lee recovered, movie production continued, and Enter the Dragon was completed successfully. Plans then immediately began for his next film, ironically to be titled Game of Death. Lee was to co-star with actress Betty Ting Pei, with whom some alleged he was having an affair. On the afternoon of July 20th, 1973, Bruce Lee and director Raymond Chow went to Betty Pei's home, where the three reviewed the new script. The director left, and Lee and Pei remained at her place. At some point, Lee told Pei he had a headache, and she gave him a painkiller that she'd been prescribed called Equagesic. At around 7:30 p.m., Bruce Lee allegedly lay down for a nap. It's been speculated that Pei was also in bed with him. When Lee missed a dinner appointment with him, film director Chow returned to Pei's home. Pei told Chow she had tried to wake Lee but couldn't. Lee's physician was called, and when he couldn't wake Lee either, they called the ambulance to take Lee to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. An autopsy showed no signs of injury and no blocked or broken blood vessels, but Lee's brain had swelled some 13%. Toxicology showed cannabinoids in Lee's blood, in addition to the Equagesic that Pei had given him. Equagesic was a combination of aspirin and the synthetic muscle relaxer and anti-anxiety medication known as meprobamate, which was America's first real blockbuster drug. Developed in the mid-1950s, meprobamate was a tranquilizer particularly popular with the Hollywood set. Some forms of Equagesic also contained opioids derived from opium poppy plants unrelated to cannabis. A dispute immediately arose among the physicians involved, including Lee's personal doctor, about whether the Equagesic or cannabis caused his death, especially considering the earlier cerebral edema incident that happened after Lee's hashish use. Famous London pathologist Dr. Donald Teer supported the Equagesic theory, stating that although people can die from THC-related accidents, cannabis never directly causes death. It just doesn't have the same direct toxic effects as many other drugs. The authorities ended up calling Bruce Lee's death, quote, death by misadventure, which is neither a recognized cause nor manner of death. Over 30 years later, in 2006, at an American Academy of Forensic Sciences meeting I attended in Seattle, a Chicago pathologist renewed an interest in Lee's death. He presented his belief that a condition first named in 1995 as sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, or SUDEP, may have been the cause of Bruce Lee's untimely demise. His reexamination of the reported autopsy results conclude that the levels of cannabinoids and meprobamate were pretty low in Lee's blood, and that allergic-type reactions to medications typically manifest as swelling of the airways and maybe the face and eyes, not swelling of the brain. Statistics indicate SUDEP deaths are more common in young adult males, and although Lee had not been diagnosed with epilepsy, he did have that previous seizure that was observed on the set of Enter the Dragon at the time of his first episode of cerebral edema. A sadly reminiscent of the Superman curse, in 1993, 20 years after Bruce Lee's death, his son, fellow martial artist and actor Brandon Lee, was killed at age 28 while filming the movie The Crow. A gun that had been used as a prop was loaded with blanks, but unknowingly a real bullet had been lodged in the barrel and accidentally struck Brandon Lee. Despite immediate surgery, he died later that day. In all these Hollywood cases, autopsy results were essential in trying to establish both the cause and manner of death. Assessing suicide, homicide, accidental, and natural deaths requires a thorough examination of tissues, body fluids, potential weapons, scene clues, and witness testimony when that's possible. But these methods are nothing new in forensics, especially in death investigations involving famous people. For instance, in 44 BCE, Julius Caesar's physician examined the 23 stab wounds on the emperor's body and deduced only one of them, a specific knife wound to his chest, was actually fatal. By around the 5th century CE, medical practitioners were fairly commonly used in Europe to help establish cause of death, expanding the practice beyond just the rich and famous. The first known book specifically about forensic medicine was written in China in the mid-13th century. Its title is often translated as Washing Away of Wrongs. This 53-chapter case-based approach includes the often cited story of a murder committed with a large blade. The investigator tested different kinds of blades on dead animals to try and determine which implement the killer used. Once he settled on a sickle as the most likely weapon, an official had all the local people bring in their sickles. When the flies were attracted to just one man's sickle, the investigator chose him for questioning, and the killer confessed. Opening and examining a body, specifically for legal purposes, was first reported in the early 14th century in Bologna, Italy, following the murder of a nobleman. And as the Middle Ages closed, using autopsy to analyze suspicious deaths became far more standard in Europe. Unlike today's forensic pathology specialists, though, oftentimes it was just a general physician who performed the autopsy. Toxicology studies were added to the standard death investigation later. as by the mid-1700s, the effects of poisons were being intensively studied in Europe. In particular, arsenic, which by this time had such a history of being used for murder, it was called inheritance powder. There have been countless high-tech refinements related to autopsy and toxicology since then. But death investigation definitely gets my vote as the oldest field in forensics. Early autopsy pioneers couldn't even imagine today's computerized chemical analyzers or scanning electron microscopes. And evidence familiar to them, like blood, carries so much more power now than it did even just a handful of decades ago when our Hollywood deaths took place. I have no idea where the future of forensic science might lead us, but it's easy to recognize how current technology would have aided justice in the past and maybe avoided some of the mystery surrounding historical deaths.